Hello, and welcome to Sea Control, the podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm your host for today, Sally Deborah. On episode 132, we'll be discussing the topic of this year's Naval Academy Foreign Affairs Conference, a new era of great power competition, with our guest, Lieutenant Jack McCain, a U.S. Navy helicopter pilot and current instructor in the leadership department at USNA. We'll also take some time to discuss Lieutenant McCain's new book, Angola, Clausewitz, and the American Way of War, now available for purchase on Amazon. In addition, regular Sea Control guest Michael DeBoer will be joining us. All this and more after this quick message about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
Welcome back. Today we are speaking with Lieutenant Jack McCain and Mike DeBoer. I want to mention right off the bat that comments made here on Sea Control are the personal opinions of our guests and should not be construed as representative of their employers or any organization with which they are affiliated. Let's get started. The theme of this year's Naval Academy Foreign Affairs Conference, A New Era of Great Power Competition, is of particular interest to our listeners here at Sea Control and our readers at SIMSEC. We'll start off by asking each of our guests to characterize their thoughts on the importance of this discussion in our current dynamic international system. Lieutenant McCain, you first. Specifically, we'd be interested to hear your take on why this discussion is important for tomorrow's military and civilian leaders.
Absolutely, and it's very much a pleasure to be here, so thank you. Well, I think that this year's conference topic is very, very prescient and very present, in that this is something that both our youth and our policymakers are beginning to have to grapple with, this idea of, are we actually in a new era of great power competition? So it's interesting to watch, and really kind of the thing that I drew out most from this conference is, this is a whole new set of challenges that are, I would say, my students from the Naval Academy, but also our conference participants are really being socialized into as a generation. Great power competition is not new to the United States or to the world, but in the post-Cold War world, the U.S. was in a very unique position and really didn't have to think about the nature of great power competition. We probably should have been, but we were very lucky in the respect to the kind of the last standing superpower. We went back and forth as to whether or not we really wanted to call the last about 20 or 25 years a unipolar world. There was a big discussion about that. That actually, some of our younger students really had some great points about it. But what really stood out was this sparking of a new conversation to kind of drive some ideation and really start to examine the implications and realities of just what this great power competition may look like in the future.
Sure. Mike, do you have anything to add or jump in?
No, I agree with all of that. I thought that the question mark at the end of that, you know, was a really useful exercise. You know, I think that we're well able to, I guess, as the people who maybe lived through the end of the Cold War or, you know, sort of saw the unipolar moment and have some historical background, I think that, like, we're probably more apt to diagnose this, but I think for, you know, it's always a useful exercise to try to, you know, take a look at and to map the international system and try to understand the international landscape for what it is, you know, whether that be great power competition or some other different model. I would agree with the premise that it is a great power competition, but I don't think that the question is unuseful. And then the other thing that I'd say for the midshipmen is that, yeah, I thought that Rear Admiral Kirby the first day put this very, very well, but it's very useful, especially, you know, and not just for the midshipmen, but the rest of the delegates to see people and interact with people that are very different than yourself, you know, have different views, different backgrounds, and, you know, different interests within the international system or international politics, or maybe not with international politics at all. And so I think that that's always a useful exercise in, you know, both academia and just in independent thought.
I hate to jump around, and I'm being a bad interviewer here doing so, but at the risk of doing that, one thing that I noticed among the panelists, among the delegates, the midshipmen, was kind of trying to wrap your head around or grasp what makes a great power.
And a lot of that discussion, you know, probably naturally went towards Russia and China. And so in your gentleman's opinion, what actually defines a great power?
After spending a week at a roundtable, that's goal was to try to define this exact issue. I think I have fewer answers than I did when I started. Our discussion really led us down a couple of roads, and everyone was in basic agreement that military power is a component of being a great power. And it really came down to actually naval power was almost viewed as a significantly more important form of military power.
That's interesting.
It was very interesting. I mean, I had 19-year-old juniors in college from civilian institutions bringing up Mahan. So I was
nice.
both heartened and surprised. So I know, and I would agree that military power takes a significant role in what determines a great power. I probably would place more emphasis on military power than economic power, just based on the idea that without security, your nation, your great power can't survive. But the notion of how that military power and how economic and diplomatic power were utilized was really the interesting part of the conversation in terms of, does a great power also have to be a moral power? Do they have to be a power that other nations, other aspiring powers, or even revisionist powers want to emulate? And that motivated a significant portion of our conversation about, does respect for human rights necessarily have to be a part of a great power? So a balance of military power, economic power are really your two core components in my own opinion. But there's a significant amount rolled up into it, especially the idea of social power or cultural power that the U.S. has either consciously or unconsciously been the almost sole dominating cultural force for both better and worse about the last 50 years. Everybody's familiar with rock and roll or blue jeans, and the golden arches are all over the world. So does that cultural power translate into becoming a great power?
I probably
would have said yes before I walked into the conversation this week, and now I'm not so sure.
Very interesting. Mike, did you have any thoughts on that?
So, yeah, I guess I have a couple. The first I'd say is that I would just say that a great power has the ability to shape events outside its own borders, which I think is, you know, maybe there's several vehicles to do that. And then while I think that it would certainly be convenient for us to say that naval power is the sine qua non of, you know, of international great power status, I'm not necessarily sure that that's always true. And I mean, don't get me wrong, no one thinks that naval power is more important than I do. But I think that might not recognize, you know, a generation of great powers that were land powers. I mean, you know, 19th century Germany, 19th and early 20th century Germany, certainly a great power with limited naval power. You know, Russia is certainly a great power with limited naval power. So, you know, I think that that's I would just maybe caution against thinking that the ability to project power overseas is the only way to, you know, affect or to shape events outside of your borders. But, you know, I mean, it certainly is extremely helpful and provides a ton of flexibility.
Okay, well, we're going to switch gears a little bit. There was a technology and cyber competition panel on which the friend of SimSec and author of the great novel Ghost Fleet, August Cole, sat. I feel that was probably the most engaged. So I have to say the delegates and Mintzman were engaged all week, but that was the most engaged I've seen them. They had a lot of questions, so we'll hit that really quick. So during this panel, August Cole said to the audience that with his experience of writing Ghost Fleet, the writing process had caused the authors to confront some uncomfortable truths. He said the American way of war is predicated on a technical superiority that isn't necessarily in line with our evolving reality. The reliance on tech creates a vulnerability, and through the lens of great power competition, he suggests that we should be thinking about the difference between our assumptions about conflict and how conflict will actually be. So I kind of want to talk to this tech or technology, both in a sense of social media and applications and military hardware. as a asymmetric vulnerability, but also an asymmetric advantage? And we'll start with you, Lieutenant McCain.
So while thinking about this exact question, weirdly enough, or maybe presciently enough, World War II came to mind. Because when you look at the way the U.S. military views technology, it's very similar to our own attitudes pre-World War II towards the Japanese Navy. We believed in our inherent superiority. We believed that one technology, notably the battleship, was going to play the biggest role in any naval confrontation that would happen. And circumstance, notably Pearl Harbor, drove a refocus, rebalance, and forced us to start thinking about problems in far more creative ways than we had had anticipated. And the true heroes of the Pacific Theater of World War II were the submarine and the aircraft carrier. And of course, the individual Marine with his rifle. So that's how I really started thinking about this, was kind of the World War II. What would force that creative flexibility? Because I agree, not only was Ghost Fleet an amazing book, by the way, but
yeah,
I agree. The U.S. military is very hyper-focused on technology, and you hear innovation in just about every conversation involving the U.S. military right now. In some way, we have to be innovative, which generally denotes a more reliance on some sort of technology as a time or space-saving utility. So what has really kind of been so surprising, especially with the cyber realm, is we kind of, at least this is my opinion, but we kind of believed we knew what cyber operations were going to shape up to look like, that they would be attacks on infrastructure or power plants, you know, the grid would go down, or the internet would be taken down. But cyber operations or information operations have taken a very different tact recently, and they did not shape the way we thought they would. Things like election influence, or especially the idea of seizing and shaping the strategic narrative using social media, using overt and covert sources, has just been incredible to watch. And that is one place that the U.S. is really far behind, is seizing the strategic narrative, because as a democratic society, moving a single narrative is actually pretty difficult because we have an open and free society. So our ability to shape a narrative is countered by what we would have believed to have been just overt propaganda. But now, because of the power of social media, is not necessarily taken as such.
That's a super interesting point, and I want to ask you sort of a follow-on question. How realistic are our policymakers about this reality, and what can future leaders do to socialize or manage this reality among the people making the policy?
That's a tough question. I think without delving into anything political, I think that there are
definitely... Sure, or prescriptive, yeah, just in a general sense.
In a general sense, you know, this is a problem that is going to force policymakers to have to take some sort of action. What that action is kind of hard to predict, because in a liberal society, we can't just go censoring messages that we don't like.
Sure.
I think having policymakers that can seize on the strategic narrative that we need, whatever it is we're doing, let's say if it's an era of great power competition, and we're trying to maintain the narrative offensive, as it were, against an adversary, we would need to make sure that it's a coherent one that's shaped not just by social media, but by the overt policy statements by the United States government. And I think policymakers really need to understand the power. You know, policymakers have an inherent understanding of the power of social media, because it's a fundraising tool, but the power of social media to shape a message and just how many people are going to buy into that message because of its nature, you know, the psychological impact of those messages are hopefully going to be realized by policymakers. But sort of something catastrophic, I think that this is going to be an ongoing problem for the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, we cheated a little bit and talked about this before we started our interview, but Mike, I know you had some pretty interesting thoughts, kind of in the same tech vein, but more along the lines of military hardware. If you can expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that the United States is probably going to maintain a while. I'm a huge fan of Ghost Fleet, and I do agree that there are areas in which our technological advantage is eroding. There's certainly areas as well in which we clearly are going to maintain a technical advantage for some time. And you know, I would point to a lot of our undersea warfare capabilities, particularly on our sensor packages, will continue to be, will continue to exceed anything that any other great power can deploy in the near to midterm. The other thing that I'd say is that in the era of combat control and all of the sort of the interstitial pieces that make up high-end naval warfare, the Chinese and Russian fleets just appear to be, well far behind. And I don't think that that's like a rest on our laurels thing or, anything that we can, say will last forever. But I think that those are places where we could continue to invest and continue to make, big strides and to get major advantages out of those systems and that expertise as we go on. I think that the other thing that's worth at least keeping a good eye on, I think that it didn't come up very much in the discussion, but the hemorrhaging of technical capability in cyber over the past, 5 or 10 years, both with, the Snowden releases and then most recently with some of the cyber tools becoming available, I think it's really also putting us at a pretty stringent disadvantage in that arena. And I think that we need to look at very seriously how we both deal with the WikiLeaks phenomenon, how we deal with WikiLeaks and other sort of major defense or national security disclosures, and not just in the realm of like whistleblowing, but in a more, in a more macro level.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we could spend the rest of the time allotted talking about tech. It was certainly one of the most dynamic panels, but we'll move on. So there's a great Forrestal lecture by General Allen, and I'll provide a link in the transcript of that so everyone can take a look and read. But he addressed what he called the 5 global megatrends affecting the international system as we know it. And they included the shift of economic power from west to east, demographic changes, rapid urbanization, the rise of technology, and climate change. I wanted to know what your gentleman's thoughts were on the general's speech and his assessment and which of these megatrends you had seen in your own experience and what can warfighters of the future do to prepare. And we'll start with you, Lieutenant McCain.
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, the NAFAC conference was incredibly fortunate to have General Allen come speak. He is a highly esteemed speaker, and this particular subject, as I was doing research for this particular talk, he has addressed these 5 points, these 5 drivers, several times, and does so very articulately, and brings to the fore some issues that we really need to start thinking about as a nation if we are to maintain a great power status. The only caveat I put on that is today we have a tendency as a military and as a nation to believe that everything that we are facing is a brand new challenge, that this is hyper new and we have never faced it before. I actually find this a significant amount with my plebes coming into the Naval Academy. Everything is brand new. So if I were to rephrase these 5 things or give kind of an overall label to them, I would say old problems, new flavor.
I like it.
Because none of these, a shift of economic power, demographic changes, rapid urbanization, even the rise of technology and climate change are not issues that we haven't faced in some form or fashion, either as a human race or as a nation or as a culture or society before. They're different, absolutely, but if we stop thinking about them as these kind of massive unknown challenges and look to history to try to draw a little bit of context, it's the best way that we can start making a plan for how to address these challenges and just how, as a nation, we're going to work to face them. One of the things that really would be kind of a team policymaker or a team president should pay attention to is not kind of the amalgam of all these problems, but the flashpoint between them. Any one of these problems can absolutely cause heartburn or cause a crisis, but when you have, say, rapid urbanization, demographic changes, and a shift in economic power away from whatever society that is, that's a flashpoint. And that can create conflict overnight. So it's not just these five things in isolation or these five things as a monolith either. It's the interactions between them that are going to be most important, and the place that if we think strategically about it, we can have the most impact is at the interaction points between these issues. He really gave an excellent speech. I can't reiterate that enough.
Yeah, we'll definitely link to that our post on that. It was certainly a highlight of the whole week for me as well. Mike, did you want to add anything on the megatrends?
I think that was an amazing talk you gave. I really agreed with all of them. General Allen was my first commandant at the Naval Academy, and he's always an absolute joy to listen speak. I've enjoyed every time he's spoken to me, and I don't think I'll ever forget his naval history discussion that he gave right when I showed up. That was like a life-changing event for me.
That's a strong endorsement for the topic of naval history.
The things that I'd say in addition, I would say that just that one, that economic predictions, particularly that far out and, you know, that long are sometimes difficult. And so I think that any sort of, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't economic shifts going on. I certainly agree that there are, but I think that also those economic shifts are the most likely to be disrupted by, you know, any changes in, you know, the world status, which are much more difficult to predict. The second thing that I would say is that, like I think that the most likely and the most determinative of those is the demographic trends that General Allen discussed. And demographics have a lot of sort of, you know, you mentioned flashpoints, and I couldn't agree more. But you know, they're certainly like a major driver in the Palestinian problem. You know, they're at least in our view driving Russia's decline. And the China older versus richer debate that I think that, you know, probably many of us are familiar with, or like all of those things are being driven by major demographic changes. While in fact, from a human capital perspective, the United States is doing, you know, like quite well, you know, like with a manageable population growth. So I think that might be like the most good news story of the group. Although it's certainly also, you know, I mean, any one of those. Yeah, any one of those could, you know, could also be a source of potential friction, or, you know, like which, you know, friction leads to fire eventually. And then finally, I thought that the other interesting thing, and I don't have a great answer for this, but I think it is it will be one of the big problems, is he talked about forced planning constructs in megacities, and just, you know, understanding what the American military had to go through, you know, or at least my understanding of what the American military had to go through, you know, to try to even project power into Sadr City or, you know, any of the other, you know, massive slums that we've sort of been, you know, operating on the edges of for some time. It doesn't paint a really endearing or joyful picture of what, you know, what future conflict in such an environment might breed. And so I think that that's probably going to be a big strain on the ground forces as they try to look at how to really conduct war in, you know, some very hostile places with lots and lots and lots of people. So I think that outlines my thoughts.
Well, we'll wrap up our conversation about NAFAC before we move on to talking about your book, Lieutenant McCain. So just in a general way, just quickly, any conclusions or consensus you drew about the rise of proto-peer competitors or great powers and maybe what the U.S. should be doing to maintain its primacy, or, you know, just share any unique insight that you've garnered from your time on the roundtables or from the conference.
Yeah, kind of to harken back to another point that I made a little bit earlier, this idea of technology's effect, especially social media, on prevailing strategic narratives is something that I really have been thinking about recently, but was brought to the fore during this conference in conversations at our roundtable. What also really stuck out was there's a lot of concern about China, which I understand there's a lot of anxiety about it, but if there's a lesson that can be drawn from the last 16 years of warfare or even longer, is that we have a tendency towards fixation as a society with regards to military operations or even just the general idea of power dynamics in the international system. You know, we like a boogeyman, and we had a convenient one in the Soviet Union for a very long time. But what that does is it has a tendency to draw our eye off the ball to places that it should be. Because just like Korea, when the Korean War broke out, that was the last place in the world anybody expected what became the proxy war between the two great powers of the time, with China folded in. And it's that kind of lack of strategic depth that puts us at a disadvantage. When we over-focus or hyper-focus, we end up undermining our own ability to think strategically about problems, and we kind of get sucked into this very tactical, how do we deal with tomorrow's challenge problem. So in all the conversations I had all week, I think that was one of the overarching points as well, is we should try to avoid being hyper-focused on one enemy or one problem, because there's a lot of challenges out there for us to face if we wish to maintain a great power status. And hyper-focusing, over-focusing, or worrying too much about one of them ends up biting us later on, or could.
And Mike, any general thoughts?
Yeah, I guess the only thing that I would say is that I'm a strong believer of, or at least maybe, I guess I classify myself as a realist, but I think that probably the most important thing going forward is to start separating and trying to focus, probably not narrowly, but precisely on national interest, and moving back to a sort of a model that we became very comfortable with in the Cold War, but I think have become less comfortable with, of identifying and then aggressively pursuing national interest against competitors. And I think that aggressive pursuit at times has been lacking, but not to criticize, you know, any individual or, you know, administration or anything like that. But I think that we've been both too expansive and then too reductive in defining what our national interest would be over the past several years. And I think that we can, I think that as we move into an era in which we certainly have competitors that are certainly interested in playing zero-sum games about national power, I think we have to become a much more steely about the way that we implement that national power abroad.
Okay. Well, great thoughts. I'm sure there's much more. And I, again, want to commend the midshipmen and the NAFAC staff for putting together a truly fantastic conference on a tough topic. Definitely lots of interesting thoughts and a lot to chew on from the week. But I want to move on, Lieutenant McCain, and talk about your new book, Angola, Clausewitz, and the American Way of War. Can you tell us a little bit about your debut title?
Absolutely. Despite the, I think I might have been a little overambitious with the title. In an attempt to sum up all of the thoughts that the book was, yeah, I rolled them into a very ambitious title. But I will say it's a short book. It's not something that you're going to sit down and have to read over a period of days. It's only about 115 pages, so it's not any lengthy endeavor. But I started this as my graduate thesis, and it kind of grew, unfortunately, out of there. And when I sat down and was thinking about what I wanted to write, I have always been interested in the South African border war because of my experiences in Africa, and it's just this conflict that nobody ever discusses and nobody knows, but there's a significant amount of value to be gleaned from using it as a case study. So I really wanted to write about hybrid war, because I'm sure both of you remember about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, hybrid war was the new boogeyman.
Right, yeah.
Hybrid war was going to dominate all future wars, and we better get with the program. So in that vein, I jumped on the bandwagon and said, okay, let's write about hybrid war. You know, carve out a little niche here for myself. And as I started researching and started trying to bring some of my own thoughts and experience to bear, I found the title of hybrid warfare to be almost useless, that everybody has a different idea of what hybrid war is or what it looks like. And I started to apply the same thought process to some of our other models. Okay, well, what is it? What does counterinsurgency warfare mean? What do we define conventional war as? And all of these labels that we have a tendency to compartmentalize operational thinking into were not useful. That I went back to my Clausewitz and pulled out a couple of kind of prescient quotes to apply here. And I'm paraphrasing, but Clausewitz describes war as a chameleon, and that the first thing that you have to do when facing any conflict is understand the fundamental nature of that specific conflict. You can't apply another model to it and expect some sort of miraculous result. It has to be treated as unique. So that kind of one thought really forced me in several different directions, and I tried to accommodate them through this work. And what it came down to was I posited that there, Clausewitz has a general theory of warfare, and I use a couple of his quotes to kind of draw that out, and that the U.S. military has gone from the general theory of warfare into what I would call middle-range theories, that we use counterinsurgency theory as a way to apply warfare doctrine. And we are starting, instead of from the strategic level, we're starting from the operational level and working out, which is not a good way to plan, fight, execute a war. The second piece that I had that I wanted to examine was the civil-military dialogue in between our policymakers and the military. Just, hey, is it functioning correctly? In an ideal case, what does that relationship look like, and do we have it right? And the answer I came up with was, in essence, no, we don't. In fact, we have balanced in the wrong direction, that the military, instead of being we will always be unequal partners, but instead of being a more equal partner, we are consulted for general advice at times, but in terms of being the foundational partner for strategic decision-making, not so much. And I use the Afghan, at the very end of the book, I talk about a little bit about the Afghan surge, and that decision-making process is a microcosm for the deficiencies in strategic decision-making and strategy planning. But with all that said, I use the South African border war as my case study because there are so many of these type elements that we would think of. You know, there's what we would call unconventional warfare. There is conventional warfare, tank on tank, and tank on an armored vehicle. There's light infantry, clandestine operations. But the South Africans never got wrapped around the axle about what type of war they were fighting. They just prosecuted the war according to the strategy that fit their policy aims, which in essence is the perfect way to, or one of the perfect ways to execute a war, is think about policy first, think about what your ends, ways, and means are going to be, balance those, execute, and reassess. So I don't want to give too much away about it, but I use it as a case study to help inform, hopefully, what can be better strategic decision-making with regards to future conflict.
Well, that's a great preview, and we'll definitely put that on our reading list and hope to maybe review it here on SimSec, one of our review cadre. Where can our readers look to purchase your book?
Thankfully, it's on Amazon as of Tuesday.
Perfect.
The Kindle version will be up hopefully in a couple of weeks, but yes, you can find it on Amazon.
Great. Well, we'll provide a link to that on the post to accompany this podcast. We're really grateful for you taking some time to join us today and talk about NAFAC and talk about your new book. And it's been a true privilege. We hope you'll join us again sometime. And again, I want to reiterate that we're very grateful to Midshipman Asdal and the whole NAFAC staff for inviting SimSec to kind of tag along. It's been a really fun week, and hopefully we can foray into the future and come back for the 58th annual NAFAC conference. With that said, this has been another episode of Sea Control. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll listen again.
That concludes episode 132 of Sea Control from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matt Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our guest, Jack McCain, our host, Sally DeBoer, and our producer, Ryan Yulia. If you enjoyed this podcast and you haven't already yet subscribed, please do. Subscribing to Sea Control gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time on Sea Control.